another is the second tier of the two-tier interest rate structure. What it says is that in section 13 on page 4 of the, we're on the dash 17 amendment.
Amendment.
Page 4 of the amendment, section 13 there, the paragraph sub 1 says that that if the department fails to make a payment of a refund within 60 days of a tax court or a Supreme Court order, then it will pay it will pay interest from that 60th day on at 4% more than the basic rate, which is one-third of a percent per month. Okay, so there's a higher interest rate on that refund if the department fails to pay. And then correspondingly, in the next section, it increases the interest rate by 4% when a deficiency or an assessment payment is not made by the end of the taxpayer's appeal rights. Okay, so the taxpayer continues to appeal, then they, and eventually loses, during that appeal time, they would pay at the lower interest rate. But once they reach the end of their appeal rights, and they are, then they're required to pay. If they fail to pay at that point, then the interest rate goes up. And it goes up by a third of a percent per month or 4% a year. Representative Scone?
What if there's an appeal or there's some other process that may be followed following one of these?
Yeah, normally, you have the appeal to the department.
The Supreme Court, I suppose, unless you went to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, we took
tax court.
Okay. Normally, the situation of the tax court is that you are required to pay the tax before you go to the tax court, unless you get a hardship consideration. So, in the normal process, you would go through your appeal rights to the department, and they would turn you down. And at that point, you decide you want to go to the tax court. You pay your tax, and then that stops all the interest. Any interest calculation at that point, you go to the tax court and deal with the issue. Now, we took into account that if you got a hardship consideration by the tax court, in other words, the tax court said, well, you don't have to pay your tax because of the hardship it will cause, then the lower interest rate continues to run during that period.
Okay. My question is, if the refund is earned by the tax court, and there's some other process of appealing to the Supreme Court, or I guess is the only place they could go.
Yeah, that's...
Well, then would the department be forced into making the refund or paying the higher rate while the case was still under appeal, as this language is written here right now?
If the taxpayer wins, mm-hmm. and it... If the taxpayer wins, the at some point along the way, the department is required to pay the money back. Now, the department could take it on further on, I suppose. I'm not sure that once you get to tax court, you usually appeal too many things beyond tax court. But the department could take it, could appeal beyond that, but they would have to pay the refund. If they failed to pay, say the person won at the tax court level, the taxpayer won at the tax court level, and the department still thought it was right and wanted to go on to the Supreme Court, the department still would be required to pay a refund. If they failed to pay that refund within 60 days, then the interest rate the department would have to pay on the refund would go up by 4%.
Okay, is there any provision for holding that in abeyance if the case is appealed to the Supreme Court?
Not if the department loses. The taxpayer loses at the tax court level. In other words, the tax court says that this taxpayer owes the refund. They can appeal to the Supreme Court, and in subsection 3 on page 4 there, if the taxpayer had not already paid the tax because they got a hardship exception, then they would continue not to pay the, or see they would let's see. They would still owe the tax if they'd lost at tax court, but the interest running during that time would still be the lower rate of interest until the Supreme Court made a decision. And if the Supreme Court then ruled against the taxpayer, then the taxpayer would have paid, would owe the tax and the interest at the lower rate for that whole period, okay, until after the Supreme Court decision was made. And then once the Supreme Court decision was made, the taxpayer owed the money, then interest from that point on would be higher.
Does the department have any interest in wanting to hold off on making the payment and having the rate of interest increase because of the subsequent appeal to the Supreme Court? I guess that's other outlet. My original question was to find out whether or not there were other means of appeal that where we'd be putting something into effect before the case is settled. I'm not sure what the response
is. I guess my feeling is that you'd have to have a huge tax liability before your decision on whether you exercise your appeals hinged on the interest rate that the department was going to pay you. Did you want to respond, though, to Representative Schoon's question?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative Schoon, in like our interpretation of Part 1 of Section 13, in the case you mentioned where we would, the Department of Revenue loses the issue at tax court, the tax court orders us to issue a refund. I'm not an attorney, but this section says we have 60 days to issue that refund before we trigger into the higher interest rate. We also have that 60-day window to appeal to the Supreme Court. And I believe if we appeal to the Supreme Court, then that stays the order of the tax court pending that decision. I don't know, maybe we need to get some legal advice on that, but my assumption in the way this was drafted would be that under that situation, that we would be in the same situation as the taxpayer, and we would not start paying the higher interest until the Supreme Court then either upheld or overturned the order of the tax court.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have a further question. Okay. Do they have any reason to pursue
it? Representative Jones?
I have a question regarding this. If, in fact, this condition exists and the taxpayer loses the case, do you currently have penalties associated with that? If in fact they do not pay. In other words, I'm looking at the fact that we're going to increase the interest rate if they don't pay within the 60-day period. Do you also have penalties associated when they have lost a case? And if so, what are they?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Jones, under current law, whether a case is appealed or not, if it's failed to pay within times defined in the statute, there is a 5% penalty.
5% for what?
5% of the tax liability.
Total?
Yes. For
and
failing
that's a
to pay,
time?
It's one time. That's
penalty,
correct.
But that penalty continues to accrue interest.
No, it does not.
Does not.
I might contrast that to federal statute. I think that question was asked during the hearing on the bill. And under current federal law, if you fail to pay, there's an additional penalty of 0.5% per month, up to 25%. So the current federal penalty could extend over a 4-year period, but could equal that 25%.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jones?
Let me follow up and make sure. In the case where the taxpayer has appealed the case, they have had to pay the tax before they went into court.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But they have it, so they have stopped the interest accruing, and let's say that the tax court rules against them. Do you, in fact, at that point also assess the penalty?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jones, in a normal appeal case, as long as the taxpayer paid the billing timely after the appeal was final, there would be no penalty.
No penalty at that point. So if they've already paid it and there isn't a... Okay.
And the penalty for failure to pay kicks in normally at the time the account is assessed. But the taxpayer has a period to appeal prior to the assessment from the original notice. As long as they appeal and at each level continue to appeal timely, there is no penalty. Okay. It's only when they've failed to pay after that issue's been resolved.
Still happy, Mr. Carlson?
I might just add, Mr. Chairman, that after your first discussion on this issue a few days ago, I chatted with Mr. Munn, the director of the department, for a few moments about your question, Representative Jones, about penalties. And he indicated fairly strong support for the need for the second tier because our penalties are not that strong. 5%, I presume, is what he had reference to, and it's certainly satisfactory to us to add the second tier as an added incentive, if you will, to pay timely and get these underpayments taken care of.
Representative Jones.
Okay, just let me clarify, because this when you're talking about the two-tier system, if they don't pay within 60 days, the interest starts accruing at a higher rate. Okay. At what point is the penalty assessed? I thought the penalty was assessed almost immediately.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jones, maybe I can walk you through a typical example on a non-appeal case, which is the majority of the ones we appeal.
Yeah, give me the normal conditions.
We would say if we audited a taxpayer and found that they owed additional money, we would send them a notice of deficiency.
Right.
That notice gives them 30 days to appeal prior to an assessment being issued. So in this case, let's assume the taxpayer doesn't appeal, so that at the end of that 30-day window, the tax is assessed, and at that point, the 5% penalty is added.
Okay, but they're starting their interest from the time that you sent the notice, right?
The interest goes clear back to the original day the return was due to be filed.
Okay.
So if it's an 84 audit, it goes back to April 15th of 85.
Right. I'm sorry. I realize that. So, but they still have 30 days, and at that point, they are then assessed the penalty.
That's correct. At the end of the 30 days, the account's assessed, and the 5% penalty is added. Then if you follow the logic of this proposal through, then they still have 90 days to appeal that assessment under current statute and ask for a hearing at the department. If they don't appeal during that 90 days, at the end of that time, the assessment becomes final, and that's the point that the higher interest rate triggers in.
Okay.
Any other questions on -17 amendments? Do we have a motion on -17?
I'll move.
Okay. Representative Jones moves it if it hasn't been moved already. Okay. Representative Jones moves -17. Is there further discussion?
Maybe I should. Okay,
Rick.
Okay, sorry to throw off the wet blanket on this, but there is a revenue impact to this change. Currently, the way the Oregon interest rates are calculated, they're tied to higher interest rates than the federal rate. So the current Oregon interest rate is 16%, the current federal rate is 9%, so that is a significant difference in the rate. We tried to do some really rough calculations, and it looks like that if that sort of on an ongoing basis, this might, if the relationship between the federal rate and the Oregon rate remain the same, if there's that same kind of a differential, that this might cost as much as $5 million a year in lost interest earnings to the department. Now, the impact during this biennium will be much less than that because the interest that has accrued to this point is at the higher rate, and it will only be interest in the future. In fact, this doesn't start till 88. It will only be interest that might start accruing after that point that will be at the lower interest rate. So that there is some negative revenue impact to this change. So we might lose interest earnings. There might also be, would there be any incentive for people to pay sooner because of the two-tier system, or is there any changes in that regard, behavioral changes that would offset those, or is At this point, even the second tier would be lower than the current interest rate being charged. Current rate is 16%. And then the second tier would be 13%. So it is an overall lowering of the interest rate, and so it will have a negative.
The Fed's going up.
Representative McCarty?
Well, I expect the Fed's will go up, but
yeah.
Is there any justification for the Oregon being 16 and the Fed's being 9? Is there any justification for that huge variation?
No, Mr.
Representative Schoon?
Let me try to respond to that because I was on the committee when we established the rules that created the current rate, and at that time we were wrestling with the problem of having a rate that was too low, and we worked and worked and worked to try to arrive at something that was reasonable, and the code says 1.5% per month, which is kind of pretty normal for credit card charges or service charges on open accounts, and that's one thing we looked at. And then we also threw some things in there that said the department director could adjust it downward if there were other circumstances after comparing market rates and all these other things. And so we tried to arrive on our own at what was right.
He never adjusted it down, did he?
Well, he did. It's actually 2%. It's actually 2% lower than it would be under the rate that we established. We also, correct me if I'm wrong on this, said that whatever we charge, we also pay to make sure that there wasn't any bias in there in favor of the state. But times have changed. We're not in an interest rate period of 20% prime anymore, and so now we're low, and the formula that we devised didn't come down enough, and so for all accounts. So I think that may answer part of the question. It doesn't provide a concrete reason. I can't tell you why the feds are where they're at.
Well, maybe you could explain to me why you didn't bring it down from 16 down to 9 to make it reasonable.
The department will have to answer that. I can't tell you why.
Well, I think you're going to answer the question.
But you're talking about somebody's actions. I don't know about that.
Okay. The advice from Rick is that the revenue impact of the dash 17 change in the 87-89 millennium is likely to be somewhat less than $1 million, somewhere around $1 million, but less than $1 million.
We've got to do a little more work on
and that. That in the future, after that, the impact could be as much as $5 million a year on future revenue forecasts, but that all depends on what the federal interest rate is, how many people are underpaying, overpaying, and getting judgments and penalties and things like that. It's a very iffy kind of number as you project out any further than the next biennium. Given that, is there any objections or any further discussion on Dash 17? Representative Jones' motion is to adopt Dash 17. Ordered. Dash 18. Okay, Dash 18 is kind of a technical correction. It's needed because there's a change in an ORS reference that's done in Senate Bill 100, so this section needs to be changed. But we also need to make this change to conform this to House Bill 2225, so we don't have any conflict with House Bill 2225. It's just a purely technical change. You can see on line 6, the change there is a change in a numerical reference. Let's do a subsection. Chair moves Dash 18. Is there any discussion or questions? Any objections? No objections. So ordered. Any other amendments on Senate Bill 100? Representative Hugo?
I wonder, is there a pressing need to move this bill today? If something else comes up that we want, that just keep this as the catch-all for a while. I don't know who else could be coming down the line to protect income tax, but...
Well, it's usually the case that in my experience on this committee that somewhere in the last week of the session, staff will bring in one omnibus conflict bill that takes all the changes that we made in all the other bills during the session and puts them together. Are there other issues that we anticipate that this committee will want to deal with in income taxes?
I was going to say, we got one more Senate Bill 100.
One more Senate Bill 100 one.
Yeah.
This
pass it out.
Yeah.
Okay.
This has to do with an issue that was raised during the hearing on the bill about the this has to do with the estate returns, that if an estate return is filed and indicates some kind of a distribution to an individual, and if that individual has failed to account for that correctly on their return, then the department can go back and adjust their return. And the bill itself opened up that time period so that if the estate return is filed quite late, that even though the normal 3-year time period had passed on reviewing the individual tax return, that the department could go back and make an adjustment in an individual tax return to that one item that had to do with what was reported on the estate return. Representative McCarty had a concern that if you could go back and open up that individual tax return from the department's side,
that the individual ought to have an opportunity to go back and make an adjustment as well. And so the department had drafted up an amendment to allow the individuals to go back and make adjustments in their returns if there's been a change in partnership, S corporations, or estate returns.
Okay, is there any discussion on this proposal?
I hate to open up that door, but
Representative McCarty?
Hi, Mr. Chairman, I think after, 3 years is long enough to find any mistake anywhere along the line. And I'm really opposed to open up return for any reason. When it's closed,
So you would be arguing against these amendments?
Sure this is good policy to open up returns. If there's a 25, there are ample reasons for them to go back on returns to check them. If it's over 25% or fraud in their income, they can open it. And, if they can't catch it within 3 years, regardless of what the situation is, I think we should close the return.
Let me respond to Representative Hugo's commentary also. First of all, I didn't know whether the purpose of that was to make it so that the first bill introduced is the last bill passed. Senate Bill 100, given its number, would indicate it was the first bill introduced by the Senate. But the other thing is that I think we're getting close to the end in this committee. And I would like to see if we can start to tie up some things and get them out of the way so that there aren't, I'd say if we kept this bill pending, that we're almost inviting people to come in with concerns, and I don't know if I personally want to keep that invitation open. We're in the last 3 weeks, depending on, and each individual's probably got your bet down to know whether we're in the last 2 weeks or last 3 weeks of session. People haven't identified their income tax concerns to this point. I would say that probably they're not of any, unless there's something that's come up in the last few days, they're not concerns of major importance, but that's a judgment that we all make. I'd just like to get moving on it. Okay. Representative McCarty?
Yeah, I propose that we get, either the tax consultants or the CPAs in to, give us their opinion of this. I would, If you want to take this idea as an interim study, I think it would be more appropriate because I don't think we've patched. Right here, they're coming in, and there's no opportunity for anybody to even look at this or consider it or anything else. If this was a big item, they should have brought it in at the first day and said, here's a problem. This is not a problem for them. Mm-hmm. Or otherwise, they would have flagged it and would have been here.
Okay, Representative Jones?
I have a question in relationship to this. I understand that the amendment actually gives you 3 years from the filing of the estate, the final estate tax return. My question is, how long does the estate have that they can postpone the filing period? I guess that would be my question, because I know what you're looking at. You're looking at being able to go back to someone on an individual basis who's received income, and the estate has not yet filed their return, so you know where to adjust. But my question is, how long does the estate have?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jones, not an expert on estate matters. I know they have to file a return within. In the case we're talking about a fiduciary return of the estate, and they're going to file fiduciary returns up until the time the court is done with, if there's determining what the will provides or probate provides. Each year they file a fiduciary return, and that's due 15 days after the end of the taxable year, that period, but they can go a long time. I was talking to the manager of our estate and gift tax unit the other day. He was just dealing with a situation where the fiduciary returns for 8 years were filed at the same time, and three of those, and the income that flows through to beneficiaries, those beneficiaries' returns were filed timely, and they were prevented by statute from requiring the beneficiary to pick up the income. They had not on their returns, and so under current law, that income is not taxed at the estate level, and it's not taxed at the individual level because we're out that return, we cannot adjust.
Age limitation.
And this would, the original bill, if I could clarify, the original bill had in it the provision to give us longer. The amendment is to give the taxpayer the same amount of time to amend. We've had in the bill since the beginning the provision to allow the department for 3 years to audit.
Representative McCarty?
Is the IRS open the door past 3 years?
Mr. Chairman, I looked up the federal statutes that I could find, and for S corporations and partnerships, we are the same, and that's the 3 year period. I could not find anything on trusts and estates that indicates what they currently do, but our reasoning is that we have the exact same situation with estates and trusts filing fiduciary returns that we have with partnerships and S corporations that flow through income. And so our rationale is that it should be the same, that we, if the income is to be reported by another party, a beneficiary or a shareholder or a partner, then we should be able to adjust their return once we know what they should report.
Representative McCarty?
In the prima facie case, this is not necessary. If it was flagged by the feds and the feds thought it was necessary, then we'll go right along with them.
Representative Calori?
Move Senate Bill 1. I don't want to do that.
Representative Hugo wants to do it.
Yeah,
Representative Hugo moves Senate Bill 100 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Is there any discussion? Janine, would you call the roll?
Representative Jones?
Aye.
McCarty?
Aye.
Trahern?
Aye.
Trahern?
Yes, again.
Calori?
No.
You were
going to
move it?
Alan.
Well, that's why I didn't move it. Forgot what I did.
Aye. That's why I moved it.
Yeah, it's good.
Aye.
You couldn't find him.
Didn't say him?
Aye. Motion is adopted. Think this, Representative Hugo? Okay. This pretty much then completes the work of the Income Tax Subcommittee. I think that this is the last item that comes out of there, so I'd like to give our thanks to that subcommittee and the people who worked very hard on the revision of the income tax code. When Representative Hugo carries it and it's concurred on in the Senate, we'll be ready to go.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
I'm not
Jones?
Wanting to lengthen this, but I just want to clarify one thing. Did I understand you correctly that in the bill as it exists today, you have already extended the department's opportunity to go back, and this amendment was giving the taxpayer the same benefit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jones, that's correct.
There's no amendment before us. Okay, we're going to try to finish on 275, and then we'll be up against the 10 o'clock window. We are excused, but we'll see how far into it we want to go into the session before the members want to go up to the floor. Maybe some issues that they'll be carrying or want to work on. Dick, are we ready to go on 275? We got the issues identified to a point where we can do something on that?
Don't have all of them drafted, but we have some drafts that the department brought over.
275.
And
Mr. Chair?
Huh?
Representative Hugo?
I move unanimous consent that we allow Representative Trahern to cast his vote on Senate Bill 100 if he so desires.
Does he wish?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Hugo requests unanimous consent to suspend rules and allow Representative Trahern to vote on Senate Bill 100. Is there any objection? Hearing none, Representative Trahern, how do you vote?
Aye.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Schoon?
Is that because you always wanted to be a yes vote on the Senate Bill 100?
Mr. Chair, void explanation.
Okay. All right. I'm sure that the Senate Bill 100 that the members are referencing was far beyond the A engrossed version by the time they had a chance to vote on it. Where are we on 275? I want to find bills that we can get out of here. 275 is not one of those, then we'll try another one. But
275 is not ready to go, I don't think. Well, okay. Unless you make decisions which eliminate
areas that might need drafting. The real question there is whether you want to deal with cases that are currently pending. Assuming that you want to go in the direction of reducing the standard for gross errors from 30 to 20%, reducing the evidentiary standard, changing the evidentiary standard. If you want that to apply to cases which are pending, we need a draft to do that. I'd like instruction to go ahead and get that draft prepared if you want to go that way.
Representative Hugo?
I would like to see that draft.
It'd be good.
But the retroactive, if you will, would only be to cases that are currently pending in the process somewhere.
Is there only two? Oh, I think there would be
only apply to cases.
Would only apply to cases currently in the process.
Well, did you want to take it out for revenue?
We take it out so that you don't have returns.
Why don't we talk about it today, and if we can figure out what to do, we'll reconsider it tomorrow.
I'm going to serve notice of possible reconsideration on Senate Bill 100. There is a question as to whether these last amendments were amendments that people wanted to put in the bill.